Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Considerations. I'm your host, J.C. Henry. Today we're going to be looking at Rand Paul and his foreign policy. Senator Rand Paul has a new and a unique approach to foreign policy. He's enunciated it through a very formidable internet presence on many talk show programs and the like. And in our day, which is March of 2015, we're facing quite a few foreign policy crises, especially with the Iranians and with the Iraqis and with the Syrians and especially with ISIS. So today in our program, we're going to look at what we can glean from Senator Rand Paul's comments on foreign policy, and we're going to try to find out from his comments what might be his basic philosophical foundations for a foreign policy were he to be nominated and become the President of the United States. Questions like, is Rand Paul a hawk, or is he what they call a dove? Is he someone who wants to go to war at the drop of a hat, or is he someone who is more deliberate in his approach to foreign policy and the use of American military power? Is Rand Paul an interventionist? In other words, every time he gets an opportunity, he's going to intervene in foreign affairs because in these areas of the world, he may, or his administration might regard it as in the American interest to intervene in the internal affairs of another country, or is he an isolationist? Does he believe in Fortress America, that nothing can hurt us, we're too big, we're too powerful, we're too, our landmass is too great? What are the opinions of Senator Rand Paul on foreign policy, and is he unique, and if he's unique, what is that uniqueness? And so today we're going to try to find out what Senator Rand Paul might feel about some of the issues today in foreign policy. So as I begin this discussion, I want to thank you for listening, and I want to start off with the first, which is just a comment that Senator Paul made yesterday to Brett Baer of the Fox News Network in an interview that he had with Brett Baer. And he was asked about the interventionist, isolationist problem. How does he regard the use of military power? And Senator Paul said, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, that he believes in the use of American power. He thinks that the most important thing the chief executive officer, the President of the United States, must do is to make sure that we have a strong military, naval, air presence, that we have those forces. Our air forces, our army, and our Navy, Marines must be fully funded and equipped and properly trained and fully supported for their efforts. He also said that he believes in the use of military force when it's in the best American interest, especially if we are attacked. And he used the example of the attack against our embassies, which in effect is an attack against us, whether it's in Egypt or Libya, in Benghazi, or in Iraq, in any other place where we've been attacked by foreign powers. However, to Brett Baer, he made an immediate comment, which I think was very interesting. He said he believes in the use of military power, but he recognizes that we cannot be everywhere all the time, nor can we be nowhere at any time. He said there has to be a balance in the use of American military power, and we have to recognize the relative limitations of the use of that power. I'd like to just stay with that particular idea at this point for the next, let's say, 5 or 8 minutes of the program. Let's just think out loud with each other about what he might be. I think the first phrase that the United States and its military power cannot be everywhere all the time. There's only a certain amount of things that we can do. The oceans are big, the land masses are big, the globe is big. There are many places in the world that could potentially be hot spots at any moment. And although we would like to think that we can be everywhere all the time and sort of like be the cop on the beat, even the cop on the beat can't be everywhere all the time. He's limited in time and space. I particularly think that that's an interesting and a good idea to realize, not that America is not a great world power or even the greatest world power or the most powerful military power in the world at this time, but to recognize that even though that is so, and although we would do the best we can to keep it up at all times, we can't be everywhere all the time. Things are going to happen. And of course, there's the immediate statement that comes to mind, well, then how do we respond? Well, you have to respond deliberately. I think that's one of the things that I would say. I was in the military for 30 years in the United States Army Reserves and 4 years in active duty. And I find that, you know, we have a strategy for the world. We have a strategy for the use of military power. We know when we want to insert ourselves into particular situations and elsewhere in terms of the kinds of war. But we have new kinds of war today. And as you look out into the future, you might want to ask the question, is the form of war known as terrorism today, the war on terror, is that really true? The previous administration under President Bush felt that there was such a thing, and President Clinton, there was such a thing, and that terrorism was a force to be reckoned with, and we could have a war on terrorism. But then, again, to just complicate and muddy the waters, or maybe clarify it, how do you respond to terrorism as a war? Let me just give a little fill-in as a background to that, as a military person myself, and that is, when we were being trained and brought into the military world, we received a lot of instruction on fighting other armies, which is to say a person, a country like the United States, would face off against another country. Even in the latest episodes against Iran, we see that Iran has an army, it has a uniform, it has a structure, it has a hierarchy command system. It's identifiable by certain patches or certain kinds of uniforms. It is a real army. And that's opposed to a bandit group, a robber group, or a terrorist group. Military forces of the world powers, all the world powers, recognize that every nation state has an army. And we're not talking necessarily about a police force, but the police force still has some of the factors of the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. But the idea is that American ships fly American flags. If they don't fly American flags, then they're pirate ships. They're not the ships identifiable as belonging to the United States. And in the world order that we live in and have been living in for quite some time, there is a recognition that nation states have a right to a defensive force, which is offensive force. It can attack and or be attacked. It can or attack. And this offensive force has a recognizable entity. It has, as I said, a uniform, some form of identity patch. The soldier has an identity card, an identity dog tag. The soldier wears a recognizable uniform. He is organized in a organization with a leadership up and down, or sideways, whatever, but with a recognizable leadership, a form of command and control. It's not random. It is not random or helter-skelter. And that military force can be expected to fight in such a way as to meet the standards of land or air or sea warfare. If it does not, then it is not legitimate. It is not recognized literally. So, and legally. So what you're saying is that the other forces that we may be facing today, which call themselves terrorists, they wear, let's take the recent issue of ISIS, they wear a black pajama thing, at least when they execute people, actually when they murder people, let's put it that way. But they're not recognized as belonging to any particular state, although somehow or other we've given them the designation ISIS, because they claim it. We give them recognition because they have some kind of motley format of a military force cobbled together of various pieces. They claim a capital at some place. They claim a leadership at some place. And they have some form of recognizing them. They call themselves by a particular name. And they rule over a certain amount of property or land, locality. interesting because even ISIS, which is named a terrorist organization, still is striving in its own peculiar way to gain recognition as a legitimated force, a legal force in the world, and that the land it controls and the territory it has sovereignty over and its military force and so on should be recognized as a legitimate actor on the world stage. So this is a little bit of a background. Now, additionally, a piece I wanted to quickly add in there, and we're going to have to deal with this in another program also, since this is only a half-hour program and I'm already into it for about 12 minutes already. But just to call attention to, in the world's military forces, the recognition of another army, its uniform, its patches, its flag, its authority, carries with it a certain code of conduct. Believe it or not, there is a manual of land warfare which outlines the procedures for legitimate warfare and outlines the procedures for the treatment of soldiers, sailors, Marines, Air Force people in a legitimate situation. For instance, let's just use an example. If I was to be in a battle with another person's forces and that person's forces were captured by mine, let's say we won the battle and we captured 25 of them, the rule of land warfare says that I'm to make them prisoners of war and that I'm not to kill them by rounding them up in a circle and shooting them all dead after we've won the battle or after they've been captured or after they've surrendered. That would be considered a war crime punishable by to myself and my forces. However, if these are saboteurs or provocateurs or partisans, they have no uniform, they're terrorists, they have no structure, they have no identity, they're not part of a national military force, then when I win the battle, I can take all of these partisans or saboteurs or provocateurs or whatever you want to call them, and I can line them up against the wall and shoot them. It's not usual, but it can be done. And it can be considered not necessarily a good thing. I hate the idea personally, but it could be allowed because these are not legitimate military forces. They are terrorists. So let's just use an example. I'm getting a little bit off the topic, but I'll go down that road since we're going in that direction. When the so-called legitimate forces called ISIS, they want to be legitimate, they want to be a caliphate, they want to be all these things recognized, when they take 21 Egyptian Christians out to the Mediterranean Sea, dressed up, notice how they dress up, all dressed up in orange uniforms. You see, that's the attempt of ISIS to claim that this is a legitimate execution by a legitimate government acting legitimately on the world scene. They do it publicly. So this is not execution style in the basement of some prison, in Lubyanka prison, during the communist era in the Soviet Union. They take them out with, quote, uniform forces. Each one of the executioners is black pajamas and masked, which the mask automatically makes them illegitimate. But, okay, they're wearing a mask. And then execution style, they kill them all by beheading. So the attempt of the ISIS terrorists is to say that we just conducted a legitimate execution, and we should not be called murderers. But the fact of the matter is they don't meet the standard. There's no trial. There's no defense. There's no evidence. They were taken out just because of what they were and who they were, which is automatically illegitimate in the world scene. They were being persecuted for being Christians, which directly controverts the Geneva Conventions agreed to by all civilized nations and recognized nations. And they were executed in a grisly manner, which was not humanitarian in any way. So it's an act of murder, no matter how they dress them up in orange uniforms, no matter how they wear black uniforms, and especially with the mask on and no trials, no anything. A completely illegitimate act of mass murder by these terrorist people. Okay, this is the world we're living in, and this is the world that Senator Rand Paul approaches, or any particular person who is going to be president of the United States of America, what do we do with this new form of violence? I don't want to call it warfare because, you know, is it really warfare? And I think that Senator Paul is cognizant of this. He's not trying to squeeze the new terrorism into the old form. This is something new, this is something different, and as he has repeatedly said, it requires a new approach, a different approach, something that can be successful against a new form of violence in the world. It's very interesting because I think what's slipping by everyone is the refusal of a person like Senator Paul to automatically regard ISIS as an entity worthy of having a name. He's not willing automatically to say that the army of ISIS, or the if there is such a thing, or is it ISIL, or is it terrorists, or is it some kind of brigade, or is it just a group of motley criminals gathered together to murder people? What is this? And maybe we shouldn't be so quick to identify it as a nation state. Now, this is in contradiction, or contradistinction, let's put it that way, it's a clearer word. It's in contradistinction to being refusing to identify it at all. I think the present administration, for instance, for fear that there is some kind of religious connotation of Muslim, it is a Muslim force, this ISIS, ISIL, whatever they call themselves, they identify themselves. They say, we are Muslims. And I said, they don't quit. We're the ones who are saying they're not Muslims. Well, it's not the same. To not grant them legitimate status as a nation state is not the same as a refusal to recognize them as what they call themselves. They call themselves Islam. Their religion, Islam. They're representing Islam, and they're attempting to establish an Islamic caliphate in the territory that they have attacked and now control. So perhaps some people might say it's playing with words. I think it's an important playing with words. We're not going to give this these terrorist fighters, the status of an army, and we're not going to treat them as though they are enemy combatants or prisoners of war. And so the recognition of this new reality is important for anyone who seeks the presidency. And I think that Senator Rand Paul has stated that he believes that there is an American interest in the region. There is an American interest because our embassies have been attacked and our people have been murdered, and that we should use military force. However, he has been quick to state that he would like to see Arab boots on the ground. Now, recently, we had the Egyptian president send his fighter jets into the territory of the terrorists and bomb them, or bomb their vehicles, or the things that they're using for their vehicles. We've had the other countries of that world join us in an air bombing and striking campaign to try to degenerate the forces of this terrorist group. And we've had the nation state, Iran, a recognized nation state, although on the terrorist list of the United States, they have sent their forces into Iraq. We understand by invitation, Iraq, and in cooperation with the Iraqi government, this Iranian force now is training and fighting alongside of Iraqi forces that we had trained and that we had equipped and that we had been partners with in the previous times. This new Iranian force is fighting alongside of them to oust the terrorists from Tikrit and eventually from Mosul and the like. Is this legitimate? Can it be done? Well, Iran is a nation state. Iran does have a recognized army. It is treating with another nation state, Iraq. These two nation states have sovereignty. If they want to join together in forces to knock out the terrorists that are occupying Iraqi territory, that's the business of the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government is not just a puppet state of the United States. We worked very hard in the previous administration to establish it as a nation state. And we can't go back and forth, Senator Paul would say, and say, well, Iraq is sovereign in certain areas, but it is not sovereign in other areas. Well, if Iraq wants to have a treaty with Iran, as much as it causes us chagrin, and as much as we might want to do everything we can to prevent it, the ultimate state if Iraq is actually an independent sovereign state and not merely a puppet state of the United States, then Iraq can do what it wants to do relative to Iran. It may have to pay the consequences if the Iranians decide to stay. You know about those things from the Cold War era when Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania were occupied by the Stalinist forces and then subsequently by the Khrushchev forces and so on until the recent liberation a few years back, 1989, 91, so on, under the Gorbachev and Jaruzelski and all that. So the whole idea of sovereign stateness enters into whether or not Iraq can make a strategic alliance. Likewise, can the United States, or would it be in the best interest of the United States? I think Senator Paul might even be so far to say, is it in the interest of the United States to make a strategic alliance, temporary as it might be, with the Iranians, these terrorist forces? What I'm saying here is that in the recent developments in Iraq, with the Iranian support of the brigade there, we might feel uncomfortable, but is it better for us to be engaged with the Iranians in a leadership role of the Iraqis? In other words, can we join with a state like Iraq that we and Iran? Can we join with a state like Iran, and which we name as a terrorist state? Can we join with them temporarily for the greater good of ousting and destroying the international threat, which is known to us as ISIS or ISIS or ISIL or whatever it's going to be called? And can we take a leadership role in assisting in ousting these forces? In other words, let's just hypothetically say the Iranian forces, since they speak the language perhaps, or they share the religion, or they have the same regional interests, or they, whatever it might be, could be working alongside of the Iraqis on the ground while we are bombing or strafing or supporting from the air. And that temporary alliance is gives us a say. In other words, if we're not engaged in the ousting from Tikrit, if we're not engaged in the ousting from Mosul, if we're not engaged in any other land-based activity, then we have no say. We're not there. If our forces are nowhere to be found in this particular conflict at this particular time, then the people who are going to have the say in what happens afterward are the Iranians and the Iraqis, to the exclusion of the Americans. And so I think Senator Paul might be a person who would look at that and say, well, you know, let's not be ultra, ultra conservative in our approach and refuse any assistance of the American forces in Mosul and Tikrit and the like, because our involvement can be predicated on our having a say in what happens after the effect. You know, this morning I was speaking with someone who told me, well, what can the Iraqis do? They were abandoned by the present Obama administration. They were left behind. They were we left the country. We pulled out our forces. We pulled out our support. We left our ISIS is using. We left our personnel carriers and our mortars, and we left our artillery pieces so that ISIS could use them. We left huge weapons caches and huge ammunition caches so that ISIS can use them. We claimed at the time, and I think we intended at the time, to leave it for the Iraqi forces, who we thought were able to handle it. At least the present Obama administration thought they were able to handle it, although it seems now to be revealed that that's against most military advice at the time he announced that he was going to pull out of Iraq entirely, leaving a token force of 400, 500, 600, a couple of thousand soldiers, where there had been 30 or 40 or 50,000 before. That decision to pull out also was to say, we don't have anything to say. Our interests were not adequately represented. Our interests and all the American blood and all the American dead and all the American wounded were not going to be adequately represented by a powerful American presence in conjunction with the Iraqi government so that we and the Iraqi government together would be able to chart the course of the future. So I think as we wind this up in the last few minutes here, so I'm in 4 minutes left to the program, we can say that Senator Paul, I think, has a realistic approach. He recognizes the changed events in the world, that we don't have a large land forces like we did at World War II, that we have terrorist forces, which are not the same as the forces of a nation state, although they claim to be, and that we will have to treat them differently. And it may be that we have to work with the enemy we know, namely the Iranians, rather than face the enemy we don't know. Now, this is a very difficult thing because recently Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel came to the United States and addressed us in a powerful way to tell us that relative to nuclear affairs and the like more, the Iranians were not to be trusted. I think it's important to note, however, that although there are some people in the United States who want to buy into Prime Minister Netanyahu's opinion, and I do too as well, that he's not claiming, Prime Minister Netanyahu is not claiming that we shouldn't have any dealings with the Iranians. He's not claiming that we shouldn't have any influence with the Iranians. He's not saying that we should act like the Iranians don't exist. He's saying that we should recognize them for who they are and what they are and then try to be smart about it and to get not any deal, because he used the phrase, I think, any deal is better than no deal at all. No, he says there's a way to get a better deal, and I think he's right about that. We shouldn't just settle and be rushed about it. It's been a long process for the Iranians. It's been a long process for us. There probably are areas between nation states where there is a mutual interest. Maybe it's so that the Iranians, who are formerly Persians, if you go back long enough, had several empires throughout the centuries. Maybe they want to have empire again. But how far does the empire go? I think under the Persian empires, they fought the Greeks, eventually maybe they fought the Romans. They were an empire then, and maybe they want to be an empire again. We have to deal with that from a historical perspective and deal with it, both feet on the ground, a head on our shoulders, and approach them from a realistic approach, which I think Senator Rand Paul, if he were to be president, would do. Okay. You're listening to Considerations, and what we've been doing is considering just the very first part of what might be a Rand Paul foreign policy. We've looked at some of the aspects, which are uniqueness of military intervention, the uniqueness of what it is to be a military force. We talked about what a legitimate army is between nation state and nation state. We've looked at some of the possibilities that might have evolved in the present era with this new thing called terrorism and the forces of terrorism. We're talking about how normally in the past we would treat legitimate forces as opposed to provocateurs or saboteurs or terrorists. And we looked at what Senator Rand Paul we think might say or do if he was to be president. Now, of course, he's going to be enunciating his opinions on foreign policy increasingly since there's a great interest in them. And I recommend the Brett Baer interview, a place where you might want to look and see what he has to say in his own words. I want to thank you for listening. You've been listening to Considerations. I'm J.C. Henry, your host, and I ask you if you'd like to push that button on there that says, that you're going to follow this program. It would be great. We'd love to have you listen to us. We broadcast every day. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm J.C. Henry.